On Dad's final day of work on a beautiful summer day, it took him well into the evening to complete his rounds, because at least one member from each family was waiting at their mailbox to thank him for his friendship and his years of service. 219 mailboxes on my route, he used to say, and a story at every one. One lady had no mailbox, so Dad took the mail into her every day because she was nearly blind. Once inside, he read her mail and helped her pay her bills, and every Thursday, he read her the local newspaper. Mailboxes were sometimes used for things other than mail. One note left in a mailbox read, "Nat, take these eggs to Marion. She's baking a cake and doesn't have any eggs, and don't stop to talk to Archie." Mailboxes might be buried in the snow, or broken, or lying on the ground, but the mail was always delivered. On cold days, Dad might find one of his customers waiting for him by the mailbox with a cup of hot chocolate. A young girl wrote letters but had no stamps, so she left a few buttons on the envelope in the mailbox. Dad paid for the stamps. One busy merchant used to leave large amounts of cash in his mailbox in a paper bag for Dad to take to the bank. On one occasion, the amount came to $32,000. It's hard to believe, but it's true. A dozen years ago, when I traveled back to my hometown on the sad occasion of Dad's death, the mailboxes I noticed along the way reminded me of some of his stories. I thought I knew them all, but that wasn't quite the case. As I drove through Marcellus, I noticed two aluminum lamp poles, one on each side of the street, reflecting the light of the late afternoon summer sun. When my dad was around, those poles supported wooden boxes that were roughly 4 feet off the ground. One box was painted green, and the other was red, and each had a slot at the top with white lettering, "Santa Claus, North Pole." For years, children had dropped letters to Santa through those slots. I made a left turn at the corner and drove past the post office and across the railroad tracks to our house. Mom and I were sitting at the kitchen table when I heard footsteps on the front porch. There at the door stood Frank Townsend, who had been Dad's postmaster and great friend for many years. So, of course, we all sat down at the table and began to tell stories. At one point, Frank looked at me across the table with tears in his eyes. "What are we going to do about the letters this Christmas?" he asked. "The letters? I guess you never knew." "Knew what?" "Remember when you were a kid and you would put your letters to Santa in those green and red boxes on Main Street? It was your dad who answered all those letters that the kids wrote every year." I just sat there with tears in my eyes. It wasn't hard for me to imagine Dad sitting at the old oak table in our basement reading those letters and answering each one. I have since spoken with several of the people who had received Christmas letters during their childhood, and they told me how amazed they were that Santa had known so much about their homes and their families. For me, just knowing that story about my father was the gift of a lifetime. John Mooy, Interlochen, Michigan, writer, son of Nat Mooy, mailman, 1905 to 1985.
The typewriter. Can you imagine this father's fear for his family when the men in hats showed up?
Our family came to Portland, Oregon in 1938, refugees from Hitler. One Sunday afternoon in 1943, when I was 7 or 8, I was playing on the living room floor when we heard a loud knock on the door of our apartment. My mother opened it and shrank in fright at the sight of two large men in hats. "FBI," they announced, showing their badges. "May we come in?" "Yes, yes," she said in confusion, shouting for my father. The grown-ups sat down at the dining room table. "Did we have a shortwave radio?" the agents asked. "No." "Did we have a telegraph key?" "No." "Did we have anything like a telegraph?" "No," my father said, his neck red with anxiety. "We had the stand-up radio in the living room." "Oh," he added, "and a little portable Smith Corona typewriter." He took it out of its black leatherette case and opened it. "Do you use it on this table?" "Yes." "Ah," one agent said to the other. "That must be it." They explained. A neighbor, suspicious of my father's German accent, had heard all this clicking and tapping. ignorant of what Jewish refugees had gone through, she concluded that we must be spies sending messages to the Nazis. "We're sorry to have alarmed you," the agent said. "Maybe in the future you could put the typewriter on a phone book to muffle the sound," they said, retrieving their hats on the way out the door. That was more than 60 years ago, yet the moment lives on. Jack Rosenthal, New York, New York, Foundation President, son of Manfred Rosenthal, Judicial Administrator, 1907 to 1975.
The tag. You may not see it, but he feels it.
A few weeks after Dad was buried, I was going through his personal effects. I opened his wallet, where I found a dollar and a couple of pictures of his four granddaughters. I pulled out his driver's license, and out fell a tag, like the ones you get on your Christmas gifts. I looked at it closely, and on the back, written in my mother's hand, was a note that said, "He tried to write his name, and he wanted me to ask you, when are you coming home, Daddy?" This man, whom I used to think I could never satisfy, had carried around for 47 years a note from his wife and 2-year-old son from Christmas 1944. I learned from this that a father's love is an enduring thing. Sometimes it's hard for children to see, and sometimes it's hard for fathers to show, but that love is always there. H. John Brandell, Wingate, North Carolina, communications contractor, son of John J. Brandell, hospital superintendent, 1916 to 1991.
The notes. Some fathers are silent, some fathers talk, and every now and then you find one who puts his feelings in writing, a few words at a time.
My father, a pharmacist, owned a drugstore in downtown Detroit where my mom served as his accountant. My brother and I liked to say that our father was a druggie and our mother was a bookie, but our parents didn't think that was funny. He loved to write notes to his children, especially when we returned from school to an empty house. Here are three of my favorites. My loving children, I am going to work and Mom will be coming home soon. Be comfortable and content, and you will be a comfort to your mother and to me. Do not burden your conscience, so it will not burden you. Your loving Dad. Lori and David. Mom is driving me to drink, which was crossed out and replaced by the word work. Dad. And my favorite, truly his final farewell. Dear children, I have gone to work to earn some money, and your mother has gone to Sears to spend some. Entertain and look after each other so that you may inherit the earth. Look after your mother and treat her with respect so that your days will be long and happy, blessed with the fruits of gratification, bringing contentment and serenity with the knowledge that the sun will rise again and again. Dad. Lori Ruskin, Newton, Massachusetts. Attorney, daughter of Harold Ruskin, pharmacist, 1914 to 1998.
The salute. He died as he lived, with dignity.
Daddy was an old-fashioned barber. The leather and porcelain chair, hot lather machine, straight razor sharpened on a leather strop kind of barber. Not the frou-frou beauty salon, stylist, fancy-smelling products kind. His barbershop was my after-school refuge, with its hot lather, those steaming hot towels, the smell of blue tonic in which black plastic combs stood, and piles of hair on the floor. He was always the room mother when I was in elementary school, an oddity in the 1960s, the only man amid a bevy of women, icing black and orange cupcakes for Halloween, and greasing the pig for field day. As a young girl, I would hold hands with him and gently step onto his perfectly shined, hard black leather wingtip shoes, one socked foot on each shoe, to twirl a bit. He was particular about those shoes. They slept with wooden posts inside them, so dancing on them was an honor as well as a pleasure. Many afternoons, Daddy treated me to a fake shave, lathering my face and imparting words of wisdom as he held me captive under a hot towel wrapped efficiently like a white cinnamon roll. Once, when my next-door neighbor upset me by disagreeing about something important to my 10-year-old mind, he bundled me in a hot towel and said, "Honey, there's an old Yiddish saying, if we all pulled in one direction, the world would keel over." I never did learn how this Southern Baptist came to be quoting a Yiddish proverb. My life was irretrievably altered when Daddy died, too young at 53 to be going anywhere, much less that far away without at least a snack. 53 seemed old to my teenage self, but it seems shockingly young now as I grow nearer to it myself. A young man named Leon worked in the barbershop, second chair from the door. When Daddy sold the shop because of his heart, Leon left to be a policeman. 5 years later, as the processional with the last bits of Daddy and over 200 cars made their way to the cemetery, there on a traffic island, alone and at attention in full dress uniform, one white-gloved hand over his eye at a full salute, the other holding his hat over his heart, was Leon, a moving tribute to a small-town barber who was so much more than that. Patricia Dye, Asheville, North Carolina, diversity consultant, daughter of Melvin Lonnie Dye, barber, 1927 to 1980.
The Protector.
"It'll be your ass if anything happens to her." John Paul Fox, father of Ruth Ann Fox Hines.
During the summer between elementary school and high school, I noticed a little peach fuzz on my face. The time had come for me to shave, I decided, so I went down to our basement bathroom, covered my face with Dad's shaving cream, picked up Dad's safety razor, and started in. Never having shaved before, I pressed the razor as hard as I could. A moment later, I looked in the mirror and saw a character out of a horror movie. Frightened, I grabbed a wad of toilet paper and pressed it against my face as I tried in vain to stop the bleeding. Just then, Dad noticed the basement light on. "Who's there?" he called. "Me." "What are you doing?" "Nothing." "What do you mean, nothing?" He came downstairs and said, "What's wrong?" "I'm so sorry," I told him. "I'll buy you a new razor." "Don't worry," he said. "We can take care of this." He took out his styptic pencil. "Hold my arm," he said. "This will sting a little." When the bleeding finally stopped, he put gauze on my wound and covered it with a bandage. "Are you going to tell Mom?" I asked. For some reason, that seemed to matter. "Well, Mom's going to see this." "Are you going to tell her what I did?" "We'll think of something," he said reassuringly, adding, "Mom won't understand shaving." Mom was out, and when she came home, Dad spoke to her privately. When she saw me, all she said was, "Dad said you scraped yourself." I was relieved. Now that I'm a parent, I realize that Dad probably told her the truth, that he probably said, "Timmy cut himself shaving, but he doesn't want you to know, so let's say I told you that he scraped himself." Kids often try to align with one parent against the other, and sometimes a parent's role is to play along with that desire, to advocate and be the protector for their son or daughter. Most kids probably have no idea how much their parents think about them, worry about them, and talk about them with each other, and it's probably best that way. Becoming a parent is the greatest moment in your life, but it's the last worry-free day you'll ever have. And yes, a few years ago when Luke started showing some peach fuzz of his own, I made sure he knew how to shave. He probably knew already, but I was determined that my son would not repeat his father's painful mistake. The net. She didn't know it at the time, and wouldn't want to have known, but Dad was there for her, even at sea.
My mother died when I was 12, and my father, a former ship's master who inspected ships in Hampton Roads, Virginia, was left to raise a budding teenage daughter on his own. Although he was experienced in many areas, he had almost none when it came to bringing up a daughter. Sometimes he was overprotective, and we often butted heads, but there was always love and respect between us. I suspect he did a great deal of praying. When I finished college at 19, the local one, because he wasn't letting me go off anywhere. I started teaching in a parochial school. By the summer, a friend was able to arrange passage for me to Europe on an Italian coal freighter sailing out of Norfolk. Papa didn't stop me, and I had 13 wonderful days as Queen of the Sea on the Gabbiano, living out my fantasy of following in my father's footsteps. I was the only passenger and the only woman. The bursar gave up his room for me. I never knew where he bunked. I dined with the chief engineer and the captain, and the three officers and the radio men entertained me, all very properly. I was told that the captain was unusually nice, and that the men were getting over their superstitions about having a woman on board. It was a great adventure. About 10 years later, after I was married with a school-age son, my father told me the real story. When I announced my plans for a sea adventure, he immediately called the owners of the shipping company that owned the Gabbiano and said, explaining that his daughter would be on board, "It'll be your ass if anything happens to her." He didn't stop me from having an adventure because I was a girl. He let me have it, and the confidence that came with it. Without my knowledge, he provided a safety net. He had run off to sea at 16 and was a ship's master by 23. I think he realized that if I had been his son, there would have been no stopping me. So instead of preventing me from going, he did what he could quietly to extend his protective arms without getting in the way. Although he is gone now, I still talk to him and ask him to keep that invisible safety net in place. Ruth Ann Fox Hines, Columbia, South Carolina, counseling psychologist, daughter of John Paul Fox, steamboat inspector, 1900 to 1981.
The caretaker. He put his girls first, even when they were all grown up and his life was ending.
My sister and I are both single and in our 50s, and Dad had always helped us with everything. Then, suddenly, the roles were reversed. I took my father to the doctor, where he learned he had a tumor in his esophagus. I drove him home and said, "What do you want to do about this?" "Whatever you want me to do," he said. "Let's see what the specialist says," I told him. 10 days later, I took him to an oncologist, who told us that Dad had only 3 weeks to live. "In all my years of treating cancer patients," the doctor said, "I have never seen so much cancer in one body." Dad extended his hand to the doctor and said, "I've had a good life, Doc, and I thank you for being honest." Somehow I held myself together, knowing that if I broke down and cried, it would only make Dad feel worse. We got in the car and headed home. When I came to a stop sign, he said, "Back up here and pull into this garage. I want to make sure they're working on your sister's car, so she won't have to go without one for long." He had just been told that he had 3 weeks to live, but he never stopped taking care of us. He didn't have any pain. 3 weeks to the day, he went to sleep one night and didn't wake up, but he was our father to the very end. Peg Everhart, Huntingdon, Pennsylvania, mail inspector, daughter of Donald P. Everhart, quality control, 1927 to 2004.
The dancer. Her dad took care of her when she developed polio, and he continued to protect her when she and the family had to face a worse fate.
My dad had a Hawaiian mother and a German father, a combination that gave him the quiet strength, sweetness of countenance, and willpower to deal with everything he encountered. His humor and passion for living endured till the day he died. When I contracted polio as a small child, he knew he had to raise me as normally as possible. So although I had steel braces on my legs, he taught me how to dance. He would gently place my feet on top of his shoes and strap my braces around his legs with a belt. The Victrola played a slow Viennese waltz as he spun me around the room. I was enthralled as he laughed at our newfound discovery of pure joy. I danced with my father all my life as he took me through many wonderful dance steps. As Americans living in the Philippines during World War II, we were imprisoned by the Japanese Imperial Army for over 3 years. We suffered great deprivation of food and freedom and experienced malnutrition and all its complications. During the last 14 months, our meals consisted of one ladle of watery rice each, 3 times a day. We would hear my mother scold my dad when he dipped his bamboo spoon into his portion and gave each of us 3 kids an extra spoonful, even though he was hungry himself. She was frightened that he would not hold up under his heavy daily workload, digging ditches, hauling heavy equipment, cutting firewood, and other jobs. But he continued to share his meager rations with us. My father was a hero to me because I saw for myself what he did. Sasha Jean Jansen, Vacaville, California, retired. Daughter of Walter Weinsheimer, sugar planter, farmer, 1904 to 1985.
The streets. You don't have to be on great terms with your son in order to give him permission to save his own life.
At 16, I was an out-of-control, selfish, irresponsible kid. We lived in a housing project in Rockaway Beach, New York, and my dad was a sanitation man and a part-time waiter in an Italian restaurant. Although he used up all his favors and connections to keep me in high school, I finally quit, which broke his heart. I worked all day and drank all night. I was in a tailspin, headed for serious trouble. I decided to join the army and figured that I just had to wait for my 17th birthday. But a 17-year-old needed both parents' permission, and Mom refused to sign the papers. This was during the Vietnam War. A few days later, I went to see Dad at his sanitation station, and for maybe the first time in our lives, we connected. I played on his military experience. He had served in the South Pacific during World War II, and begged him to talk to Mom. Less than a month later, I was Private Walter A. Arcario at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. Dad even taught me how to sight and shoot a rifle, over the phone. I was sent overseas, but to Europe rather than Asia. While I was in the Army, some of the guys I knew back home wound up on drugs, in jail, or dead. Meanwhile, I was becoming a better man. There are no snooze alarms in the Army. You have to be where you're supposed to be, and you had better be early. My goal was to get out with an honorary discharge, and I did. Some 30 years later, shortly before Dad passed away, I asked him why he had supported my decision to join the Army at such a young age. I had 2 sons of my own by now, and I needed to know. He pulled me close to him, looked me right in the eye, and said, "I would never have been able to live with myself if I lost you to the streets. Thank you, Dad." Walter A. Arcario, Rockaway Beach, New York, safety consultant, son of Joseph B. Arcario Sr., sanitation man, 1914 to 1994.
The big man. A daughter's pride in her dad comes in all sizes.
I was about 4, and we were at Bradley Beach, New Jersey, when I somehow lost my way between the water and my family. I wandered the beach, terrified. All I could see were legs. I couldn't find my way back. I cried. Finally, I heard someone call, "Andrea!" It was my father, and I ran to him. He picked me up and carried me back to our blanket. I was safe. He always made me feel safe. Physically, he was a big, strong man. When I was a kid, he seemed huge to me. Not fat, just big. He stood just over 6 feet tall, but his strength came from the broad chest and big stomach. My father loved to eat. He could not be left alone in a bakery or a delicatessen, or he would buy out the place, as my mother would say when he came home on Sunday mornings, with bags filled with white fish, onion rolls, and apple turnovers. I loved his bigness. I loved that he could pick up my bicycle with one hand and carry it out of a sudden rainstorm. I loved how he could carry my overpacked suitcases and load them effortlessly into the car for the drive to college. When he developed diabetes in his late 50s, the doctor made him lose the gut. He lost 30 pounds and became slim. I knew he was healthier, but I hated how he looked, and I never got used to it. Andrea Mizells, New York, New York, educator, daughter of Monroe Mizells, hardware salesman, 1927 to 1994.
The Strong Man. Get ready for a real Kodak moment. A fridge with feet.
My dad was only 5'10", but everyone called him Big L. He spent his adult life doing manual labor, mostly construction work, but despite the long hours, Dad always had time for others. If I close my eyes, I can still hear the garage door going up on a Saturday morning and the two-wheeled dolly being loaded into his pickup. He was always helping somebody move something. If you needed a favor or wanted something moved, you called Big Al. He was always there with a strong back and a big smile. When I was 5, we were moving to a new house about a block away, and the strap to the dolly was broken. Dad looked at our mammoth fridge, and he looked down the street at the new house. Out came the inside shelves, and then Dad got inside, lifted the fridge on his back, and started walking. All you could see was this refrigerator at a 45-degree angle moving down the street with two legs sticking out. Mom was yelling, "Al, you're going to have a heart attack." We heard that a lot over the years, but Dad was laughing and moving down the street, one step at a time. Our neighbors began to gather, and I remember standing with some kids on the sidewalk, swelling with pride. My dad was the strongest man in the world, and everyone knew it. Steve Royer, Elkhorn, Nebraska, software executive, son of Al Royer, cement finisher, 1931 to 2000.
Tolerance.
He had been spiritually wounded by the racism of his day, but never became embittered by it. He still believed that people were basically good. Joyce Turner Heathcock, daughter of Kenneth L. Turner.
Some years ago, when General Colin Powell was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I drove over to the Pentagon to meet with him. During my visit, when I asked him to direct me to the men's room, he said, "Actually, we have twice as many of those as we need in this building." "Why is that, General?" He explained that when the Pentagon was built in the early 1940s, the state of Virginia still practiced segregation, so the builders put in separate bathrooms for whites and coloreds. Maybe I shouldn't have found that shocking, but his comment stopped me in my tracks. We like to think of racial segregation as something that happened long ago, but in certain places and in a lot of memories, there are still some vivid reminders of that unhappy era. I grew up in an all-white neighborhood in a northern city, with parents and teachers who talked often about racial tolerance. The Sisters of Mercy at the schools I attended used to tell us that man was created in the image of God, and that the Spirit of God could be found in every human being. Of course, not everybody practiced what the nuns preached, and the N-word was sometimes heard on the streets of our neighborhood, but not in our house. Once, when my older sister told a story that included the word Polack, my sister Kathy, who was probably around 7, reprimanded her. "B.A., you're not supposed to say that. You're supposed to say colored person." Kathy was a little confused, but she had the right idea. My father, who worked with men from a wide variety of backgrounds, used to talk to us about not making assumptions on the basis of somebody's skin color, and judging from the letters I received, so did many other fathers, for on no other subject did I read so many similar stories. When Dad was a foreman in the streets department and heard that Jimmy, one of the workers on the garbage trucks, was making ugly comments about blacks, he teamed him up with a light-skinned African-American. A couple of weeks later, Jimmy told Dad that his new partner was a good, hard-working Italian kid. He's not Italian, Dad said. He's colored. And I hoped you learned something. I know that story because Dad came home and told it at our dinner table. Although our society is far from perfect, in recent years we've made real progress in racial equality and religious tolerance. Legislation and judicial rulings are the instruments of change, but a fair and just society really depends on individual acts of respect. Our hearts are formed when we are young. The letters in this chapter demonstrate the unique importance of a father's good example. The real story. Actions really do speak louder than words, as his daughter was delighted to learn.
From everything I could see, my father was a racist. He spoke in derogatory terms about the black men who worked for him. A lazy crop of humans, he said, spending their pay on booze and leaving their women to care for all those children. Conditioned by my Girl Scout education, I was acutely sensitive to the plight of black people. I would rail at my father's generalizations and his inhumane assumptions, but I got nowhere. I was ashamed of him and took great pains to make sure that none of my friends ever engaged him in a conversation about race. Once, when I tried to talk with him, Dad said, "When you've seen as much of the world as I have, you'll realize that people are not as good as your Pollyanna-ish spirit believes." When I countered that there were plenty of no-count whites, Dad shrugged and said, "Someday maybe you'll understand." I continued to regard my father, who was normally so compassionate and understanding about other people's problems, as a bigot, and he indulged me as a bleeding heart. At the age of 65, Dad died unexpectedly of a heart attack. As was the custom in Baltimore, there was a viewing of the deceased before the funeral, where the family was expected to escort the mourners to have one last look. I hated the process, but as a dutiful daughter, I escorted various friends and relatives, all of them white, with the exception of our black laundry lady, who told me that Dad had always thanked her for the way she ironed his shirts. "Like a queen he made me feel," she sobbed. Then, as the last of the visitors hurried in, I was sought out by a gigantic black man. "You must be the daughter," he said as he clasped my hand. "I'd be most appreciative if you'd walk up with me to view your daddy for one last time." His strong grip left me no choice. "I'm not sure I know you, Mr.—" "No, ma'am," he whispered. "I'm the dispatcher at the company. Just call me Joe. You know, if it wasn't for your daddy there, I'd be sweeping up the dispatch room and washing down walls and mopping floors. But your daddy saw something in me and helped me work my way up to be a dispatcher. He was always there for me, when my wife got sick, when the children acted up, even the time I was arrested for getting a little drunk. He was the one person I could count on. Yes, sir, Mr. Frank was the only white man who really understood what it was like to be colored." I squeezed his big black hand with unbridled compassion. Joe had given me a remarkable gift. He taught me to have faith, no matter what the outward signs might indicate. Celeste Ulrich, Eugene, Oregon, retired professor, daughter of Frank G. Ulrich, transportation supervisor, 1903-1968.
Tan skin. He was no longer around, but she gave him the benefit of the doubt, because he had earned it.
My father would have loved my children. He was born in 1889, and some of his eight older siblings were born while the family still lived in a sod hut on their Dakota Territory homestead. His world was very different from mine, but my father would have loved my children. This may not seem like such a remarkable statement. Most people love their grandchildren, but some do not, especially when their beloved daughter marries a man of a different race and has children with tan skin and curly little afros. My teenage son looks like he just escaped from a rap video, with baggy pants and a big crystal in his ear, but my father would have gotten a huge kick out of him. He would have loved that my son inherited his gift for math. He would have loved his sense of humor, and he would have loved him because he is mine. He would have loved my daughter because she is such a great listener and would sit attentively as he told stories of graduating from high school at 14 because he read through all the books in his one-room schoolhouse. He would have told her about managing a classic old hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, and having President Roosevelt visit, and the man who carved Mount Rushmore living there. He would have been impressed that she could put anything together, even without the directions. I won't deny that a racially mixed marriage might have been a little difficult for him to get used to. After all, I grew up in the 50s in a town where a mixed marriage was one between a Lutheran and a Catholic. And even back then, people asked, "But what about the children?" But he would have gotten used to the idea, and he would have loved my children. My father was a man of some dignity, but he wasn't careful with his language. He never hesitated to call someone an SOB if he was one, or to identify BS when he heard it. But the only way I ever heard him describe a black man was as a colored gentleman, and this was long before I ever met anyone who wasn't white. What he cared about was a person's character. His health began to fail when I was in high school, and some days, when I came home from school, I would find him sitting in his big wingback chair facing the bookshelves. On the shelves were pictures of each of his children. He once told me that he went from picture to picture much of the day, stopping at each of the five and saying a prayer, because that was now his only way of taking care of us. He thought we were the best. My father died a few years after that, but if he had known my children, he would have thought they were the best, too. Susan Demersman, Berkeley, California, psychologist. Daughter of Bert Demersman, businessman, 1889 to 1965.
Father of the neighborhood. He had every right to be angry, but he still completed his mission.
My father was born in 1917. When he was 18, he built and flew an airplane. I remember him, late in life, describing how he converted an old Chevrolet car engine into an airplane engine. He wasn't able to get the plane too far up in the air, but it did fly, and some people who witnessed this feat still talk about it. He was drafted into the Army during World War II and was deployed in the Solomon Islands and the Philippines, where he saw active duty in an all-black company. Only late in life did he tell me that he had continually applied for flight training until a white officer told him that his applications were pointless because when it was known that he was black, his paperwork was thrown in the trash. Although the news broke his heart, he always said it was an honor and his duty to fight for his country. After the war, my father was known as the father of the neighborhood in our section of Indianapolis. Anyone in need could call on him, and he would find a way to help. He fixed cars, radios, televisions, furnaces, air conditioners, and did plumbing and electrical work and charged nothing. He bought groceries for people he knew were in need, and we were not a wealthy family. He loved unconditionally and always strove to see the good in people. He was a magnificent, courageous, generous, caring, loving man who had been spiritually wounded by the racism of his day, but never became embittered by it. He still believed that people were basically good. Joyce Turner Heathcock, Indianapolis, Indiana, computer operator, daughter of Kenneth L. Turner, supervisor, 1917 to 1998.
The offering. She broke his heart, but his love for her was strong enough to overcome his bias.
I grew up in South Buffalo, where my claim to non-fame was that I was a Protestant. I was born on St. Patrick's Day, which gave me some standing. I envied all my friends dressed in their First Communion outfits and tagged along to do the seven churches on Holy Thursday. But all through my childhood, my father kept warning me not to be taken in by the hocus-pocus mumbo-jumbo of the Catholic Church. He was my rock. He He had never finished high school and worked most of his life at a coal plant. Our first and only house had cost him $2,500, and it remained the source of his greatest joy. The only place we ever went was to visit relatives, and we never, ever ate in a restaurant. We shopped for clothes only when necessary, and played canasta and rummy at night, while eating popcorn and listening to the radio. When I was accepted at Mercy Hospital School of Nursing, my father had a fit because of those conniving Catholics. Finally, with the persuasion of Sister Mary Ellen, he allowed me to go. One night I was caught out after hours at a tavern, drinking beer by the pitcher. Sister Mary Ethel drove down there, walked in, and expelled us on the spot. I had to call my dad to come and pick me up. This was the lowest point of my life, and I was devastated, because I knew I had hurt him deeply. But no words were ever spoken. The next day he was gone all morning, and when he came home, he told me to get in the car. He pulled up to the nurse's residence and proceeded to unload packages from Sears Roebuck and Western Auto. I had no idea what was going on, but he marched me right into Sister Mary Ethel's office and asked her to take me back. He then pulled out a clock for the foyer wall, a new 25-cup coffee maker, and a huge box of chocolates. I was mortified, but Sister Mary Ethel accepted the peace offering, and I was reinstated. That clock hung there for years, and it always brought back the memory of my father saying, "Honey, there had better never be a next time." And there wasn't. After graduation, I moved to Westchester County and worked in a hospital. I had been a Catholic for about a year, and after another year or so, I decided to enter the convent. This meant really hurting my parents, and it was a struggle I endured for another year. Finally, I took the coward's way out and wrote to them of my intentions. 2 days later, my father showed up to try to talk some sense into me, as his worst fears had come true. The Catholics had stolen his daughter. At the convent, he met with Mother Mary Mark and some of the other Franciscan sisters. When the meeting ended, he was laughing and joking with them. I almost fainted. My father, who thought nuns were the female rejects of society, had made peace with his worst fear. As we walked to the car, he said, "They're not a bad lot. They even let me smoke my cigar." We had a real heart-to-heart talk that night. "Well," he declared, "you will never make me a grandfather, but to see you happy is an answer to my prayers." One of the girls I entered with was Eileen Paul, the daughter of Ralph Paul, the announcer on the Ed Sullivan Show. My dad thought this was really great, and the two of them became fast friends. I could come home only once a year, but when I did, Dad had everyone he knew at the house. He was so proud. When we visited the World's Fair in New York, he loved the respect that people showed me, especially when it put us at the head of a long line. The good sisters loved my father, and when they visited Buffalo, he and my family would take them to see the sights. My father died of cancer at 62. I had come home to be with him, and all over his room were pictures and letters from the nuns and their students. He had a Lutheran funeral, surrounded by Sisters of Mercy, Franciscans, and two Catholic priests. The people my father once perceived as his enemy had become his biggest allies, and it happened because he never let anything get in the way of his love for me. 10 years after I entered the convent, I left, married, raised 3 daughters, and never let anything get in the way of my love for them. My dad taught me well. Karen Andrewshat, Wyoming, New York, nurse, daughter of Fred Raby, factory worker, 1901 to 1964.
The Inspector. One man's junk is another man's dignity.
I have many fond memories of my dad, and the final one was in January 1967, after he died suddenly at the age of 50. Walking into church for the funeral, I noticed a row of impoverished men, dressed in what must have been their finest clothes, sitting in silent, sad attention. These were the hobos who hung around the railroad station, where Dad worked as a car inspector, and they were there to honor the man who had supported them for so long. For years, he had been bringing home square glass ashtrays with chips and cracks in them that he had purchased from these men who had nothing. I guessed that they had probably been lifted from restaurants or hotels when nobody was looking. We also had a large and unnecessary collection of fly swatters that Dad had also been buying from these men who had nothing. He always had money for them, and he knew it was better to buy what they had to offer, whatever its origins, than to give them a handout. He believed that, like anyone else, these men deserved to be treated with dignity. Jan Pope, Emily, Minnesota, nurse, daughter of Ray Ludwig, railroad inspector, 1916 to 1967.
Mr. Strawberry. A dad follows his heart, and a stranger becomes a friend.
When I was 10 and helping out at my dad's liquor store, a man walked in looking disheveled and confused. He told Dad he had no money, his car had broken down, and he was trying to get home. Without hesitation, my father gave the man $20 and called him a cab. "Dad," I said, "that guy was a bum. Why did you do that?" He said he could see from the man's eyes that he was telling the truth and was in trouble. The following Christmas Eve, flowers were delivered to our business, addressed to Joseph Kelly and his son, wishing us a Merry Christmas and signed Mr. Strawberry. For the next 40 years, the flowers came without fail. I finally asked Mr. Strawberry, who had become a regular customer, why he sent us flowers every year. He told me that on one of the worst days of his life, on one of the hottest days of the year, his car broke down and he, a black man, was then mugged by three white teenagers while he was trying to get help. His insulin was low, he was dazed and confused. Nobody except Dad was willing to help him. And he would remember that as long as he lived. Joseph Harrison Kelly, Bordentown, New Jersey, investment advisor, son of Joseph Harold Kelly, liquor store owner, 1925 to 2003.
The coincidence. Her father stood up when it counted, and she remembers.
Although my father achieved professional success and financial comfort, he refused to leave the Bronx neighborhood that he and my mother were raised in. We lived in the same fifth-floor walk-up that my mother lived in as a child. When our neighbors decided to buy a house on the island, Dad refused to consider leaving the city he loved. By 1963, white flight was beginning to transform our neighborhood, and before long, the first African-American child took a seat in my Catholic school classroom. Birthday parties were about the biggest social events a third grader had to look forward to, and I was delighted to receive an invitation to her party. Then I learned that none of my friends was going. I remember being confused by that because we all went to one another's parties. But if my friends weren't going to this one, I wasn't going to go either, especially when they seemed convinced that there was something wrong with the very idea. I no longer remember the exact conversation, but Dad put his foot down and told me that, like it or not, I was going to that party. He took me to the Five and Dime, and we bought a card and a gift. The day of the party, he took me by the hand, and we walked the three or four blocks to the girl's apartment. My whining and complaining were useless, and it wasn't until many years later that I understood why he made me go. He knew why none of my friends was there, and he wanted no part of it. No child of his was going to contribute to the hurt that would surely be felt by a little girl sitting at an empty birthday table. More than 40 years later, this is pretty much the only childhood birthday party that I actually remember. I was treated like a very special guest by the girl's family, but mostly I remember it because of the laughter I caused when Dad came to pick me up, and I loudly pointed out that the girl's entire family was dark,
just like she was. What a coincidence.
Margaret Hackett, Highland, New York, legal clerk, daughter of James Hackett, fire commissioner, 1912 to 1967.
Big aid. When a father doesn't brag, sometimes it takes until after he dies to know the full extent of his goodness.
My father was known as Big Aid, which was short for Adrian Francis Sauer, Jr. He enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps right after Pearl Harbor, although he eventually washed out because of a fractured skull from childhood. He graduated from Infantry Officers Training School at Fort Benning, where he was trained to help lead what would have been a suicidal invasion of Japan. The A-bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki just before he became a second lieutenant. These awful events probably saved his life and gave me mine. Then he came home to start a family. He loved the Army, but he didn't want to drag his family to Army posts across the nation and around the world. Instead, he bought a luncheonette on the main street of Haddonfield, New Jersey. He called it Aid's Lunch, where he figured out that he was not in the food business as much as the entertainment business, and where people of all classes and colors ate in equality. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, when the Yankees were in the World Series, Dad would rent a black-and-white TV to put on top of the phone booth so his customers could join him in cheering for the Pinstripes. His favorite player, and mine, was Yogi Berra. Big Aid's second job was serving in the New Jersey National Guard one weekend every month and for 2 weeks each summer at Camp Drum in Watertown, New York. Dad loved the Guard, but Mom and my brothers resented it because of the time it took from us and the strains it put on the family business. In the summer of 1967, his Guard unit was sent to Newark, where a riot had erupted and police were having trouble containing it. Dad went without having any idea how dangerous or how long his mission would be. When he returned many days later, he told us that his job was to drive through the fiery city in an open-top jeep with his M1 Garand and to ferry intelligence from one point to the next. He said there was enough gunfire to keep him on his toes, and that this was the only time in 34 years of military service that he had ever been in combat. That was all he said. When Big Aid died a few years ago, we had both his memorial service and his wake in a local restaurant. There were old photos of him on display and artifacts from his sports career, Aid's Lunch, and the Army. His favorite Glenn Miller music was playing in the background. The celebration of life was scheduled for 11 a.m. with drinks and lunch at noon. Suddenly, at 10:45, 30 of Big Aid's National Guard comrades came into the room, most of them wearing caps with their unit's number on it. They greeted me as if I were their long-lost son and expressed their sympathies with tremendous warmth and a few tears. I immediately understood why my father treasured his Guard experience and had such love and respect for his buddies. A clergyman friend of the family, who used to eat an Aid's Lunch when he was a boy, gave a great homily. I somehow made it through the eulogy I had written for my dad without breaking down. Then, as I made my way around the large room to say thank you, one of Big Aid's old Guard buddies, Sergeant Jeep McAdams, grabbed the sleeve of my suit. Jeep told me that it was my dad who encouraged him to go into the Guard after World War II, which saved him from driving a cab in Camden for the rest of his life. "There are so many stories I could tell you about your old man, Richie," Jeep rasped into my ear, "but let me tell you at least this one. You know we were in Newark during the riots of 67. It was a combat situation, let me tell you. I want you to know what an excellent and brave soldier your old man was. He was a true leader. We were called to a building that the state police had their machine guns trained on. They said they needed backup because there were rioters in the building. They told us to help them take this position with tear gas, machine guns, grenades, whatever. Your dad challenged the state cops from the get-go. He asked them what made them think there were no innocent civilians inside the position. The state police were zealous, you see. They had already fired shots, and they wanted us to fire warning shots, but your dad asked them to please hold their fire. Then he volunteered to assess the situation. He stayed low and got to the big door of the building, which was locked, and he calmly announced, "I'm with the New Jersey National Guard, and I'm here to lead you to safety. Everything will be okay. Follow me." Suddenly, about 25 black high school kids came out of the building behind him, shaking and crying. Your dad was comforting them with one hand and giving the "hold your fire" sign with the other. He asked if they needed water or food. Rich, your dad treated those kids with such respect and kindness. If he hadn't gotten involved, I'm sure there would have been bloodshed, if not death. This was what I learned for the first time at Big Aid's memorial service. Could I be more proud of him had he won the Congressional Medal of Honor? I don't think so. Rich Sauer, Ocean City, New Jersey, nonprofit fundraiser, son of Adrian F. Sauer, Jr., 1922 to 2001.
Discipline.
God loves you, and I'm trying. Peter DeMattia, father of Kevin DeMattia.
In just about every family we knew when I was growing up, the mother was the nurturer and the father was the disciplinarian. That's how the roles were divided, and in many families it still is. As long as mom and dad were united and consistent in their approach, the system worked. And although dad's disciplinary tactics were rarely appreciated by his kids at the time, I could have filled this whole book with grateful testimonies from sons and daughters who were at the receiving end years ago. One man wrote about getting in trouble as a teenager for being part of a group of kids with rifles in their car. The police took them down to the station, and when this man's father came to pick him up, he expected a long lecture. Instead, to his shock and dismay, his father told the police, "Keep him." He spent a day clearing brush on a road gang, he reports, and was never in trouble again. "I figured that if my own dad wouldn't bail me out, nobody would," he writes. What a great lesson in being responsible for your actions. Gary Trudeau, the creator of Doonesbury, told me that as a teenager in the 1930s, his father Frank went to Germany to watch the 1936 Berlin Olympics. When he ran out of cash before the games began, Frank sent a telegram to his father, asking him to wire money. I love the 8-word telegram his father sent back. "Dear Frank, too bad. So sad. Love, Dad." Can you imagine a father responding that way today? Frank Trudeau stayed in Germany by borrowing money and finding odd jobs, and I have a feeling that years later he thanked his dad for teaching him about responsibility. President Jimmy Carter told me that as a youngster his main goal in life was to please his father, which he did by helping out on the family farm. His father used to call him Hot, short for Hot Shot. One night when the future president was 12, his parents threw a party with a lot of drinking and dancing that went on well into the night, keeping the youngster awake. Furious, he went outside and spent the night in his treehouse. Shortly before dawn, his father noticed the boy was missing and started calling him. Jimmy didn't respond, but he snuck back into his room, where his father eventually found him. "Why didn't you answer me when I called you?" his father asked. "I don't know, Daddy." That was one of about 5 times, by Carter's rough count, that his father gave him a whipping. This one hurt the most, he said, probably because his parents had been so worried when they couldn't find him. Commenting on his father's painful punishments, Carter said, "He only did it when I deserved it, like the time he shot his sister in the butt with a BB gun. But all those whippings are memorable," he said. "I would imagine so." Times have changed, and I don't know any father who strikes his child. Still, there are times when a parent has to exercise a little discipline. One summer when Luke missed curfew for a second time, I grounded him. But I realized that this punishment was inadequate, and I had to do more to ensure it wouldn't happen again. I drew up a contract that said if Luke came home late again, he would lose the use of his pickup truck for 2 weeks, and would stay home for two consecutive weekends with no whining, no appeals, and no complaints. Luke signed it, and the deal held. I'd love to claim credit for this idea, but it came from a conversation with Yankee shortstop Derek Jeter. Before every school year, Jeter told me, he would sit down with his parents and they would write up a document outlining what they expected of him in school, on the playing field, and at home. They would all sign it. "So was this your first contract?" I asked him. "Yes," he said, "and it was also the most difficult one to negotiate." "And what would happen if you violated the terms of the deal?" "Referring to the signed document," he said, "you know, I was pretty good." And he still is. The captain of the Yankees with a long-term contract. The Proposal. There's an old movie cliche in which the brave commander slaps one of the recruits across the face and the younger man says, "Thanks, I needed that." It was also used in a commercial for Men in Aftershave. Sometimes that slap is verbal, and sometimes that younger man is a full-grown adult.
When I finished college and Dad was driving me home, he said, "You're a little screwed up." "What do you mean?" "You've grown into a good-looking man, you have a strong back and a quick mind, but you worry too much about money." "We never had any money, so of course I'm concerned about it. You don't know what it's like not being able to take my girlfriend to a movie or a dance." "Well," he said, "don't worry about money. Worry about being the best at whatever you do. It may be hard for you to imagine, but we are miles better off than my parents." Then he said, "Hey, you ever seen a hearse with a luggage rack?" In the next few years, I was so focused on my career that I lost my wife, who had been my college sweetheart. Dad said, "Looky here, have you ever heard of the art of living? That's when you can't distinguish between a man at work or at play. By the way, how are your funds holding up?" "Dad," I said, "I make almost twice as much as you." "Yeah, I know," he said. "I just like to hear it." I was 27 when I met Jamie, an Ivy League beauty who loved me, and I loved her. But I was still snake-bit from my first mistake, so I wanted to live with her before getting married. That was fine with Jamie, but my going to Mass twice a week mother was less than pleased. "You were raised better than that," Dad told me. "But listen, son, times are different. I'm not saying I condone what you were doing, but figure out what you need to figure out, and I'll keep your mother at bay." 2 years later, when Jamie and I were living in Albuquerque, and my parents were in Indianapolis, Dad called and said, "Tom, we need to talk. What's your Friday like?" "It's open. What do you need?" "Fly up here Friday morning, and I'll meet you at the airport." "How long should I stay?" "This shouldn't take more than an hour. We'll talk at the airport, and you'll take the afternoon flight back. You're going to be busy this weekend." When I got off the plane, he was waiting for me. "Let's get down to business," he said. "You in or you out?" "In or out with what?" "With Jamie." "Jamie's great." "Terrific. When is the wedding?" "Whoa, Dad, who said anything about a wedding?" "Look," said Dad, "I know that things are different than when I was your age, but when it comes to matters of the heart, not much has changed. Jamie's a beautiful young woman, and your mother and I adore her, but that's not the point. You owe it to Jamie to be in or out. She's quite a gal, and she might be the mother of your kid someday. Treat her like it. You guys are young and have a lot on the ball. This country needs good families, not selfish young adults. So, are you in or out?" "Dad, I'm in. But why did you say I was going to be busy this weekend?" "Well, if she says yes, you'll be out shopping for a diamond. Trust me on that, kid. And if she says no, you'll be packing her up and putting a 6-month deposit on a nice apartment for her." "You want me to propose now?" "I think your chances are better in person. Have a safe trip." 8 months later, we were married, and Dad was my best man. 6 months later, we took my parents on a vacation to Hawaii. 10 months after that, Dad died in his sleep. Thomas A. Barr, Albuquerque, New Mexico, entrepreneur, son of Jerome A. Barr, electric utility manager, 1925 to 1992.
The board. Why are kids so often surprised that it's not easy to put one over on the old man?
When we were about 10 and 12, my brother and I decided it was time to start smoking. But where would we hide the cigarettes? We found a loose board in the attic. Just the place, we thought, because the attic was a great venue. After all, nobody would smell smoke coming from the attic. Two sons of a volunteer fireman, smoking in